I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 28th, 2015. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. With me today, Vice Chair Senator Costello and myself, Chair Senator Giesel. Other committee members are in transit at this point. Today our recording secretary, Ann Krekelberg, helping us out with the audio is Thatcher, so welcome. We will be hearing today from our two legislative consultants, Janik Mayer and Nico Safus from Analytica, and they're going to complete the confidentiality subject and then go on to give us an overview of major natural gas pipeline projects. And welcome, Senator Wielichowski has joined the committee. So gentlemen, while you're coming to the table, I learned something very interesting in Labor and Commerce Committee yesterday, chaired by Senator Costello. We had a report from the Department of Administration, and who knew that there was a union entity called the Confidential Employees Association? And apparently these are folks that manage payroll information, and their average salary is around $59,000 a year. So the Confidential Employees Association is one of the union entities that the state negotiates with. I didn't know that. Welcome, Senator Michicki. He's joined the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So welcome, gentlemen, if you would continue with your confidentiality subject material. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. For the record, Janik Mayer, partner at Analytica. We are, of course, consultants for the legislature on contract through Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. We do, as you say, have one slide to finish up from our previous presentation. And to get on with it, I will hand over to my colleague, Nico Safus.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Nico Safus, a partner at Analytica. I want to just dive straight in. This is slide four of the presentation from Monday, January 26th on confidentiality. And I just wanted to take maybe half a minute to remind you how we got to this slide, which is one of the major distinctions that my colleague Janik made in the discussion about confidentiality was to distinguish between confidentiality during a negotiation and confidentiality of the agreements at the end of a negotiation. So I want to talk about both of these issues on this slide. And how we got to this slide was, you know, as you think about confidentiality, what are some of the broad questions that you can ask yourselves in terms of how to manage the AKLNG process? The first and very crucial question is, if I were a legislature in your position, I would be thinking, you know what, at the end of the day, how much information do I need to pull the trigger? What do I feel I really need to know at the end of the day? Now, having said that, you know, LNG projects generate tons of information. A sales and purchase agreement could be anywhere from 50 to 100 pages, and you may have three or four of those. An engineering procurement and construction contract could be about 13 to 1,500 pages, right? Loan agreements could be tens or hundreds of pages. And as we said before, there is a lot of information that companies will be happy to have publicly available and some information that companies are going to be a little bit more private about, in particular around pricing. And so we thought as a useful sort of analogy, we looked at the Snøhvit LNG project. That is a project in Norway. And so we went actually to look at the Storing, which is the Norwegian parliament, that gave approval to the Snøhvit LNG project. And we went through the public record to see basically what kind of information did legislatures have over there and how did they handle some of these questions about confidentiality. What we thought was interesting was that there was actually no, at least we couldn't find on the public record, there was no mention of the precise pricing that Snøhvit LNG was selling the gas for. But what there was an estimate of how much money was going to make, the sensitivity of how much money was going to make under different scenarios, the expected return, rate of return to the state. That was basically the main way in which the Norwegian parliament sort of was able to assess whether it wanted to give the go-ahead to the project without getting into some of the more confidential aspect, which is individual contracts. Now, obviously, there are differences with Norway. in the Shinobit LNG project, there were actually two state-owned companies involved, Statoil and Petoro. And so obviously the state of Norway has other ways in which it monitors, regulates those state-owned companies. So there are some differences. But we think this is a broad question to ask, you know, what is the kind of information that you really feel you need to have in order to give the green light to authorize, you know, the $6 to $15 billion that we said might be required at that time. And I think the sooner you know that, the easier it is to point the administration in that direction to make sure that it negotiates agreements with the understanding that these will be public. Because the sooner you know that, you know, the easier it is to say, okay, knowing that this is going to be a public document, you may negotiate things differently than if you think this is not going to be a public document. I think the earlier this comes to the negotiation, the more helpful it is. The second broad question that I would ask, and this is really speaks both to process as well as the end result, is, you know, are you willing to give up something for having more transparency? And I put this in very broad terms. And this is the example that we were thinking about when we made this question. Cheniere Energy is a company in the lower 48 developing an LNG project. And basically, they are, to my knowledge, the only company that has taken final investment decision on an LNG project where a member of the public can access every single LNG contract that they signed. So you can just go on the web, type in, you know, sales and purchase agreement between Cheniere and the different players, and you can read this document. To my knowledge, it's the only project that really has gone to that level of transparency. Now, there are some specific reasons for that, which is that they were selling gas from the lower 48. It was a new pricing system. They wanted people to buy into the pricing system, so they had to be a little bit more transparent. And so one of the questions is, you know, maybe in order to have transparency, you're willing to give up some of your flexibility, right? Because the more you say, look, this is what I want, and I want to be able to negotiate everything in public, you know, that creates some sidebars in terms of what you can and cannot talk about, right? And so one of the trade-offs you can say is that, look, transparency is more important to me than having that flexibility. And so that's, I think, a very legitimate conversation to have in the context of the LNG project. And then the last comment I would say is more about the process. You know, in our understanding of SB 138, the idea is the administration negotiates, but you have the ability of the legislature to provide input to make sure that the administration doesn't go and negotiate something that has no hope of passing the legislature, and that this happens both in public meetings as well as executive session. But really the bedrock, at least in our understanding, is, you know, that at the end of the day, if I recall correctly, SB 138 said if it's any agreement that is in effect for more than 2 years, you have to bring it back to the legislature. That's a broadly speaking, my recollection. Now, that process to us seems to have a lot of merit. It definitely seems preferable to just giving a green light to the administration to just go negotiate whatever they want. It also seems preferable to sort of forcing the administration to negotiate on the front page of the newspaper, which also makes it very difficult because you have no ability to sort of trade and achieve the state's objectives over a cross range of issues if everything you say becomes instantly available. And so we think that that last part really goes to both of the previous questions, which is, you know, it's worth making sure, you know, in our understanding, the agreements come back to the legislature, make sure that, you know, are those agreements going to be 100% available, or are they going to be parts redacted, right? That's an important conversation to have. You know, is it possible that, you know, you may have a contract that is fully available except for the price and some sensitive clauses, and you have other ways of getting that information? For example, having us as consultants do economic analysis that doesn't reveal the specific formula but talks more broadly about the prices and revenues that you can expect to earn. And so we think that's a good conversation to have. I don't think there was an answer last year in terms of when those agreements come back, whether 100% of every single agreement is going to be fully publicly available. I don't remember from last year's debate if that had been resulted, and I think that's a really good conversation to have because, you know, saying that you have to approve an agreement, about half of it you can't see, it's going to be tricky, right? But it goes back to the first point, which is, you know, in our mind, a key question for the legislature is, you know, and for individual legislators, you know, what do I need to see in order to feel comfortable to pull the trigger, right? And that we think is a good conversation to have. So that's what I have to say on confidentiality, and I'll take a pause here, and otherwise we can move to the next presentation.
Very good. Questions from committee members? Senator Costello?
Thank you, and through the chair. So currently there are several commissioners in the administration that will be involved in negotiating a contract, and do you think that if they choose not to sign a confidentiality agreement, will that, in your opinion, put them at a disadvantage? And I realize the role that you play, but I would like a comment on that.
Senator Costello, through the chair. I think that depends on a lot of different variables, right? And I think it's important to distinguish between their role and any confidentiality agreement they do or don't sign, and, for instance, the confidentiality agreements that individual legislators would have with the administration to enable them to share things with legislators that may not be about necessarily, as we've said, company proprietary information, but about the state's negotiating position and the details of that. And I think in particular what we'd like to say is ability to confidentially share the state's negotiating position between the administration and the legislature is deeply important. In terms of the administration themselves and senior members and whether or not they sign confidentiality agreements, I think is going to be, you know, something detailed to work out, and as far as understanding how much of the final information they need to make a decision can be obtained without that. And there isn't one single clear-cut answer to that question, I think. I have no doubt that there will be people in the administration that do need to sign and, to the best of my knowledge, have signed. Certainly, were I the commissioner of a department, I think, you know, while there is obviously a balance between the desire to do everything transparently and to have the best information available, I would, on balance, like to have the best information available to me to make a decision and feel uncomfortable if I didn't. But there are specifics that will vary case by case in terms of how one can make that decision if one doesn't have access to all confidential information.
So the previous speaker just now was Jenick Mayer. I'll just remind guys, if you would please identify yourself. I also want to take a short break here to recognize that Senator Coghill joined us at 3:35, and Representative Christ Tompkins is here in the audience joining us. Welcome, Representative. Did you have additional comments, Nikos?
I was well covered.
All right, great. Did you have a follow-up, Senator Costello?
I don't, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on the confidentiality subject? All right, great. Well, thank you for covering that for us. And then you were going to go on and give us an overview of the project.
Indeed, Madam Chair. For the record, Jannick Mayer, Analytica. And, thank you for picking me up on that. We wanted to present to you a high-level overview of, a reminder of where we ended up both last session and further progress since then, particularly, you know, because after all of the work and effort that went into the legislative passage of SB 138, it's tempting to sort of want to think, oh, you know, we put all that work in, that's done, thank goodness, now the administration can go off and do a bunch of things, and we can worry about that a little bit further down the road. And I think one of the things we want to draw people's attention to is just how much there is to be done, what a tight time frame was set out last year, just how much work there is, particularly for the administration, to do over the next 12 months, and what the legislative implications of that are, and all the things that legislators need to really be thinking about from this point forward if the timeline that was set out last year is to be met. So we want to talk about that on a high-level overview, and then specifically get into two areas that we have focused on in recent times. In fact, prepared two papers that Nikos will talk about a bit further. One on marketing Alaska's gas and LNG from the project, and the other on domestic markets and how major LNG projects like this one are likely to affect the domestic market for gas and how one might want to start thinking about the policy approach that's taken to that.
Great. Thank you.
So to start off, of a high-level overview, this is a slide we showed many times last session in terms of what does the overall timeline ahead of us look like. Broadly speaking, you know, and most of what's on this chart, other than the final two lines that go into the actual sort of dollar figures specific to AKA LNG and the state's share, you know, could apply to almost any similar LNG project anywhere in the world, by and large. What it sets out, you know, are the sort of three big phases, stage-gated phases, timeline-wise, that lead up to eventual construction, all things going according to plan, hopefully middle of next decade. Before we can get to that point, there are essentially three stages that the project goes through. Pre-FEED, which is what the project is in now, FEED standing for front-end engineering and design, followed by FEED itself, and then finally the construction phase. And you can see on slide two here the broad timing involved in each of these phases. So in the pre-FEED stage is essentially a stage where all of the detailed but still to some extent conceptual work around what this project is going to look like is done on an engineering and technical, financial, commercial, etc. perspective. So that's everything from defining the precise routing of the pipeline, defining all the different technologies that are going to be involved in everything from gas treatment and processing to compression stations on the pipeline to the liquefaction project itself, and getting to a lot of detail about where things will be sourced from and starting to really much more narrowly define what this project looks like, and therefore go from this initial sort of estimate of $45 to $65 billion to a much more tightly bounded estimate of, based on everything that we've specified and where we think we're going to source it from, what does this project actually start to look like. When that process is completed, one eventually reaches a stage gate where all of the partners need to sit down, look at all the work that's been done, and come to the decision whether or not to move on to the next stage of spending money to do further work, further refining the project, which is the front-end engineering and design process. That is then the very detailed specification of every last flange and valve and equipment component of the entire project that ends up with pages and pages of precise documentation and blueprint and all the rest that can be the basis on which the project is then put out to bid for engineering, procurement, and construction. Precise details that the sorts of companies that actually physically build these things can put in a bid and say, yes, we can build this for you, or this component of this for you, and this is what it's going to cost. Eventually all of that work is completed and it comes time for a final investment decision to be made on the project, and from that point then there's another 4 or 5 years of construction period before the project comes online. But during that entire process, there are countless other activities that need to be going on hand in hand. During the pre-FEED stage, for instance, all of the parties, including quite likely the state of Alaska, will be looking at marketing their share of the gas from the project. That starts out with high-level initial meetings, getting participants in the market aware of the project and interested, and eventually sitting down and signing high-level non-binding agreements, memoranda of understanding, heads of agreement, to scope out what a potential future binding gas supply gas purchase agreement might look like. By the time we get into the FEED process, that is then about signing steadily more binding heads of agreements, for instance, and eventually signing sales and purchase agreements. By and large, by the time the final investment decision is made, a good 70% to fully all of the gas for the project from all of the partners is likely to be contracted through firm sale and purchase agreements, because part of reaching final investment decision is lining up the financing that is then enabled by those binding long-term contracts to sell the gas. That said, there may, you know, for instance, be a small tranche of unsold LNG at that point, and possibly during the construction phase there are additional negotiations for additional buyers even during the construction phase. On the financing front, there is a lot to be initially determined over this period about how financing for all the different partners works, whether that is each of them individually or together through some form of joint venture. And some specific questions on the financing front that the state in particular needs to grapple with over the next 12 months that we'll talk about in some more detail. Once we get into the FEED stage, then we're getting into much more detail around, you know, looking at term sheets, defining terms, and eventually at some point signing loan agreements as well as the hundreds of pages of other agreements that Nikos referred to a little while ago. Even there, though, once FID has eventually been taken during construction phase, there may still be further financing that is brought on. Part of the nature of these projects, of course, is that as they progress in timeline, the risk profile of the project falls and financing becomes cheaper. So there may be some tranches of financing that are only, in fact, signed during the construction phase because it will be cheaper to do so than at FID, and it's not required for FID. And once the project is itself online, there may be refinancings of earlier tranches of debt or other form parts of the capital structure that can now be made cheaper, either because of changes in market conditions or because the project is now online and therefore substantially de-risked, that can be financed more cheaply. One of the points we made a number of times at this table and others last year is that in terms of the project ownership and structure, that is more than likely to change and change numerous times between now and the middle of next decade. When we look at any number of other projects comparable in the world, what they looked like before FID and what they looked like when they actually came online in terms of the ownership structure were very, very frequently substantially different. At various points in this process that we've laid out, some partner may decide that actually it's difficult for us to see how this is a fit for us, while others want to go ahead, a new partner could be brought in. At other times, you know, you sign a sale and purchase agreement for gas with an Asian utility and they say, well, this is terrific, but ideally I'd like to take a bigger share of gas and actually also have an equity stake that goes with that. And so a way of finding out where that equity stake comes from and whose equity holding is brought down to enable that. All of those things happen as the project progresses. In terms of the amounts of capital that we're talking about for each of these stages, broadly, the public estimate is $45 to $65 billion for the overall project. In terms of spending up until construction, really we're talking about the sort of $500 million mark in terms of for the project overall for all of the partners combined during the current pre-FEED stage that we're in. Once we reach FEED, then we're talking about $1.5 to $2 billion of further spending on that very detailed engineering work. And eventually, when it comes time for FID and the decision to be made to go ahead, that's when the real money is committed. In terms of what the state's share of that looks like, with the participation of TransCanada in its current form, we're talking about sort of $50 million that the state has to come up with for its share, primarily for its 25% of the liquefaction project in terms of its spending towards reaching, for the overall project to reach pre-FEED, then around the $200 million mark through the FEED process. If at any point the state were to decide it didn't want to continue with TransCanada as a partner, for instance, not signing, if it were not to sign a firm transportation services agreement with TransCanada and say instead actually the state would like to have its own share of its 25% in the gas treatment and pipeline, it would be on the hook for substantially more, both paying back some of the expenses that TransCanada had incurred up to that point, and then carrying the full weight of its 25% throughout the project, which would put it more in, for instance, the $500 million mark to get through the FEED process. And then once again, depending on that in terms of both involvement of TransCanada and the degree to which the state decides, for instance, to exercise the option that it has under the agreements that were signed last year to buy back into TransCanada's share, will determine what the total capital demand on the state is once FID is taken. But at the moment, based on that sort of $45 to $65 billion range and the question of whether TransCanada is involved or not, we're talking somewhere between $6 and $15 billion of capital that, through some combination of debt and equity, the state would need to provide to cover its 25% share under that structure. So that's a very high-level overview of what the coming many years look like.
Great. And as you're turning the page, I want to notice that Senator Stedman joined us about 10 minutes ago.
to look specifically then at what the agenda is for the next 12 months or so. It's a short slide. There's only sort of five lines on here of things that need to be done. When we actually start talking about what those things are, it's not just five things. It's an ambitious and really quite daunting program in terms of what needs to be negotiated and agreed over the next 12 months or so by the original schedule to get to a decision to move the project into the FEED stage on time based on that initial timetable. So we have, broadly speaking, five categories here. Agreements that are about work that is about the technical work stream, essentially. Commercial issues and agreements, organizational structure and agreements around that, fiscal issues, and finally the regulatory process. And I want to spend a bit of time drilling down into each of those five and what's actually involved in each of those, and thinking a bit about what the legislative implication of some of those things are, and what are the things that legislators need to start thinking about now in terms of the negotiation process that the administration is going through and things that are going to be coming back here, and how the legislature could or should be involved in any of those things. The technical side of things is probably the least directly relevant for the legislature. Obviously, that's a process that largely is run by the project team themselves. The joint venture, the project that is being managed by Steve Butt, who I know has spoken here on numerous occasions, and the entire enormous team of amazing experts that they have doing fantastic technical work on everything from pipeline routing to buying land to figuring out technical specifications of an enormous range of things. Lots of work to be done, but work that will be done over that time period by the project team. There is, of course, sort of interaction with some of those things in terms of route and location with other aspects of this, like FERC permitting, and we can talk a little bit about that in a moment. On the commercial front, there are a lot of agreements that the state is going to need to negotiate, and some of which, all of which have implications for the legislature, and some in particular that legislators may not need to start thinking about sooner rather than later. One of the things that Nikos will be talking about shortly is domestic gas and how large projects like this impact the market for domestic gas and how one thinks about market structure and regulation for a domestic gas market when there is this enormous mega project as part of it. But certainly the question of how this project participates in the domestic Alaska market for gas, how it provides gas to the interior, for instance, and to Alaskans across the state is a huge part of that. And as part of the agreements that are going to be reached to enable us to get to the next stage here, the question of whose obligation is it to provide gas to the domestic market, how much gas needs to be provided, is that something that comes out of the state's share of the gas, is that an obligation that is more broadly borne by all of the partners in the project, which I would suggest is the more likely and more likely to be in the state's interest. For all of the partners to be involved in meeting domestic gas needs, but how that is structured, what those obligations are, how that interacts with the domestic market and the best approach to the domestic market are things that a lot of thought needs to go into quite soon, because that domestic gas agreement, either on a standalone basis or as part of some of the other agreements that are here in terms of offtake and balancing and fiscal stabilization, is going to have to be something that a lot of progress is made on over the course of this year. The structure that we talked a lot about for the project last year in terms of how this project works was essentially one where if the state can reach a point where it's comfortable with a range of things that need to come together for it to take its royalty and its tax entitlement as gas, the structure would be one where the state had, roughly speaking, 25% of the equity in the entire infrastructure project, 25% contributing 25% of the capital cost of building it and holding 25% of the equity in the project, and took 25% of the gas. And the basic idea of that, as we talked about a lot last year, it was in some ways of one project overall, but four projects in a project. That is, each partner having their share of the gas, and contributing their share of the costs, and each essentially being able to operate for many purposes almost independently of each other.
Excuse me, Janik. Senator Sidman had a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just so I follow along correctly, because sometimes it gets confusing, and I've been kind of, we've been on hiatus since last April. Has there been some change in the relationship with TransCanada? Because I was under the impression that TransCanada has basically an option on portion of what TransCanada is going to hold in the pipe and not the liquefaction plant, but the gas treatment plant. Has that been changed?
Senator Sidman, through the chair. The basic nature of that relationship is the state has signed a memorandum of understanding with TransCanada. As part of that process, as part of what was enabled through SB 138 last year and agreements that came out of that, TransCanada, for the time being, holds the state's 25% share in the gas treatment processing facilities and the pipeline, while the state retains its full 25% of the liquefaction project. For practical purposes, what that means at the moment is that when it comes to cash calls for the actual work that's being done at the moment, let's say $125 million in total for the state's full 25% in everything, the relevant portion of that for the GTP and the pipeline is being funded by TransCanada, and TransCanada is contributing all of their technical capability into that process.
I guess let me clarify that. Good. And maybe I should have. Maybe I'm just garbled up on my links. I'm under the impression that it's going to be very difficult to completely buy out TransCanada. We can buy out a portion of their 25% interest in the pipe and the other plant. But you're telling us that we have the option that we can completely take them out of the picture if we want.
Senator Sidman, through the chair, the state has not yet signed a firm transportation services agreement with TransCanada. At some point, that agreement will be negotiated and finalized and need to be either approved or not. If at that point the state says, yes, we want to go ahead with this, firm transportation services agreement is signed, and at that point a completely binding commitment will have been made to TransCanada, under which they will, through feed, construction and eventual operation, carry the state's share in the GTP and the pipeline and receive a tariff from the state for the state's share of gas in return. Until that firm transportation services agreement is signed, there isn't that binding commitment to them. If that firm transportation services agreement is signed, then along with that, at that same time, the state has a right to exercise an option to say we would like to buy back in, I think the number is 40% of TransCanada's overall share, and so the state continues to have some of both the capital call to contribute toward that share of the project and the share of revenues that come from that share of ownership. So those are two separate decisions that have to occur at the same time, one being, does the state wish to continue with that structure by signing the firm transportation services agreement? And the other being, if it does it want TransCanada to bear the full 25%, or does it want to buy back in and reimburse TransCanada for the costs associated with 40% of that 25% share in those two components?
Okay. Thank you.
So on the question of if the state can reach the point that it is comfortable taking its royalty and its tax entitlement as gas, there are a lot of things that need to come together to make that determination, and the determination of whether, of the various risks involved in doing that, whether those can be adequately managed through the range of proposed contracts that set out the ultimate structure here. One of the agreements that's going to be crucial to understanding whether the risks involved in that are truly managed or not is going to be the uptake and balancing agreement that is signed. Now, the reason this is crucial, of course, is that under this proposed structure, everyone has an equal share of the gas, everyone has an equal share of the pipe, etc. But the one thing that isn't the same among all players is the upstream component. The state would not have a share of the upstream, it would simply have a share of the gas through its royalty and tax entitlement. And in particular, we would not be, obviously, an operator of of either of the fields. So we have four different other high-level partners here, two of whom are operators, one of Prudhoe Bay, one of Point Thompson, a third partner that is an equity owner, a working interest owner in both of those projects, but that does not have operatorship, and then the state that has an entitlement to the gas, but does not have either a working interest ownership or operatorship. And to the extent that implicit in taking royalty and tax in kind is incurring a bunch of obligations to other counterparties, in particular counterparties that the state has signed a firm binding sale purchase agreement with that both binds them to purchasing given quantities of LNG, but also binds the state to meeting certain requirements in terms of the amount of LNG it can deliver and the schedule for doing so. The state needs to make sure that it can meet those obligations given a wide range of circumstances that could occur on the upstream end. If there are outages, if there is a failure of one field or one part of a field to deliver, what does that mean for the state's share of the gas? How does the state make sure that it can always meet its obligations to other counterparties, as well as what it needs from a financial perspective for the investment to make sense in a wide range of climates, when it doesn't have direct control over the upstream fields? So there is a lot of analysis and work that's going to have to go into those offtake and balancing agreements before the state can get to the point that it can look at all these things and say, yes, royalty and tax taken in kind are in the interests of the state. Similarly, part of what needs to be understood by the time that decision is made is how is disposition of the state's gas going to work? There are a wide range of things that could be done. SB 138 talks about, as part of a royalty in kind decision being made, the producers needing to show that they are willing to sell the state's gas on terms as advantageous as they themselves receive, and that is one option that the state can pursue. As Nikos will talk about in a moment, there may be reasons why, while having that option is desirable, the state may want to consider other options as well, whether that be seeking expressions of interest or putting out a tender, both to the major producers and to other major players who will buy the state's share of gas in total, or in fact staffing up and mounting its own LNG marketing operation and contracting directly with buyers in Asia. And Nikos is going to talk at some length as to why there may be an interest for the state in considering some of those alternatives to simply having the producers sell the state's share on the same terms. But decisions about how those things could work need to be made, and how those things and those possible commitments work in with offtake and balancing agreements, and the interaction of all those things all need to be understood before you can get to the point of making that decision to say, yes, royalty in kind is in the interest of the state and we want to proceed. Then, of course, there are a range of decisions to be made around financing and how the state meets its ultimate equity share here. One of the crucial things is going to understand is going to be what the state's financial capacity to do all this. This was we talked on the previous slide about between $6 and $15 billion capital call on the state to be able to do this. Those are scary enough figures to have as a discussion last year, let alone this year in the changed climate we see at the moment. Obviously, there are a wide range of ways the state could meet that commitment, whether both in terms of how that is met in terms of equity and debt. On the equity component, how much of that comes from the state's recurrent revenues, how much is it possible either to use distributions from the permanent fund, leverage the assets of the permanent fund, the other assets of the state. There are a broad range of things to consider, and depending how one considers these things, gives a wide range of different answers on what is the actual capital constraint of the state and what is actually financeable by the state. These things are going to become very important both for the administration and the legislature to consider sooner than one might think, because at the moment, under the agreements that were signed last year, the timeline is later this year. If I'm not wrong, I think it's October 2015 that the state has to come back to the question of the firm binding transportation services agreement with TransCanada and the question of whether they exercise their option in the pipeline and GTP portion of the project. given that signing firm transportation services agreement with TransCanada also implies that the state is saying that it has molecules of gas that it wants to transport through a pipeline, that also then impacts the royalty in kind decision. But to come to all of those decisions requires A, things like that uptake and balancing, the LNG disposition, a lot of progress to be made on all of those fronts, but it also requires the state to have said, okay, we have actually a good sense of what the range of financing possibilities are here, how much the state can actually raise in capital, both in equity and in debt, and whether that be debt, the liabilities that the state takes on directly, whether that be sort of non-recourse forms of financing that may be more expensive, what each of those things costs to the state, and for instance how that compares to TransCanada's involvement in the whole thing and the implicit cost of financing involved in paying a tariff instead to TransCanada. There are obviously a wide range of benefits that come with TransCanada's involvement in terms of their technical expertise, and we talked before in great detail about what they bring to the table as an independent pipeline company, for instance, were it possible for them to be the operator of the GTP and the pipeline as an expansion-minded party whose interests may in many cases align better with the state than the other producers potentially. There are certain benefits that they bring to the table, but they also come to the table with a certain cost in terms of the tariff that is proposed that they would charge. And it's really important to look at that and be able to do a firm comparison of what that compares to the different possible capital structures the state could have were it not going with TransCanada. What would that mean for the state's credit rating? What's the likely cost of debt the state could have in different circumstances? And how do we assess, in a really concrete term, the costs and benefits of TransCanada's involvement? Under the current schedule, unless there's an extension, those things need to be decided on by October this year. I just want to let that sink in for a moment, because that's a lot of things to consider, a lot of things to get very firm analysis on before one can make good, well-informed decisions on some of these things.
Senator Sidman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for those that are home that are watching, maybe you can explain why there's this deadline come fall, or appears to be a timeline coming at us.
Senator Sidman, through the chair. It is premised on a number of things. Partly it's the timeline that is set out in terms of target dates for going from pre-feed to feed, and the fact that TransCanada as a partner, you know, at the moment is contributing enormous resources of its own, the financial aspect of which would be reimbursed if the state didn't proceed, but a lot of management, you know, time and effort and other things that for the moment it's willing to commit to this project on the good faith that the state is interested in them being involved in the full project further down the line, but at some point the state needs to make a firm commitment so that TransCanada can continue with that security or not. And the stage gate between pre-feed and feed is quite reasonably the point at which that is set. So is it possible to extend that under some circumstances? If it becomes necessary, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Quite possibly it is. But extending that also then pushes out the whole timeline for the rest of the project, as well as requiring further good faith from TransCanada that they can keep to contributing to this without the firm transportation services agreement that they really need at some point.
Senator Wielichowski.
Thank you. Do you think there have been any changes that we need to take into consideration? Obviously, the pricing has changed, but has anything fundamentally changed since the passage of SB 138 that have maybe sort of changed what's happened? You know, the way we need to look at this project, or the way, I guess, the passage of the bill. I mean, is there anything that's changed so significantly in either the market or the pricing or the supply-demand that should cause us to look at, take a relook at SB 138?
Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, for the record, Nikos Safos. My broad instinct would be not yet. But if I may, I would like to split that answer a little bit more. You know, I think in today's commodity environment, this will be very difficult to do as a project. Having said that, I think that would be a challenge for the project rather than the specific structure envisioned by SB 138. So, you know, if it really takes $50, $60 billion to bring gas in the North Slope to the market, it's not clear that changing the structure will make it more economic. So I think the ultimate question is whether or not the current commodity environment sort of persists, and that's going to be very challenging for this project to be viable. So my answer would be not yet. If this low oil price environment persists, I think it's going to pose a real challenge to the project. But I think the solution to that will not necessarily be to rejig the structure and, you know, change SB 130. It will be to completely rethink about how you're going to develop gas in North Slope.
Follow-up. Will we know by October? I think I know the answer, but...
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I would add one thing to that, which is to bear in mind that, you know, one of the great things this project has going for it is, you know, in the best circumstances, it wouldn't come online until the middle of next decade, right? And it's really important to bear that in mind, to think about the changes that we've had in the commodity price environment just in the last 5 years, and the fact that for any of the companies involved, and as it should be for the state as well, you know, when they think about these things, when they think about a project that's going to come online ideally midway through next decade and earn its return on capital over the preceding two decades after that, we're really not thinking primarily about, you know, what's the price of oil and the corresponding price of gas in Japan today. Okay. Try to keep making progress to get to the substance of some of Nikos' slides shortly. On the organizational front, of course, a further bunch of agreements to be done. The joint venture and sort of governance agreements that will govern the project. There are obviously some initial agreements that govern the project through the pre-feed stage. There are going to similarly be governance agreements that govern how the project works through feed and to the point of FID and how FID is reached. Things, you know, that determine, for instance, who has veto rights in what circumstances, what can be decided through a majority of the shareholders, what requires agreement from everyone. Probably, certainly a heads of agreement as to what that ultimate structure and governance agreement looks like will need to be negotiated over the next several months if it's not already, and at some point that's going to need to be finalized over the course of this time frame. Similarly, as part of reaching a royalty in kind determination about the state's willingness to take its share in kind, are going to need to be a series of decisions for the Commissioner of DNR to make about royalty, about lease modifications, both about specific terms and in particular about things like sliding scales and net profit share leases that need to be converted to a single gross amount to work with the idea of royalty in kind. Finally, of course, there is going to be a very substantial agreement to be looked at in this time frame on the question of fiscal stabilization and what is needed to be able to take an eventual final investment decision on this project in terms of guaranteeing to some degree stability of fiscal terms specifically for this project over whatever period of time is required to have sufficient certainty to make a final investment decision. And of course, there are going to be certain barriers that need to be overcome as part of that, because of course, for instance, the state of Alaska has particular requirements in terms of the constitution of the state of Alaska and not binding future legislatures, etc. There are a number of possible strategies that could be examined that can both provide the certainty the project needs and meet those requirements. Some of those may ultimately need to be tested through the judicial process. So there's a whole range of things that need to go with that, as well as the difficult and contentious negotiations around that agreement itself and what that looks like. The state also needs to come to agreement on the way property tax for the project is treated. Over the last several months, Nikos and I have both been attending meetings of the Municipal Advisory Group Board that has met in Anchorage over the last several months last year to look at the question of what alternate structures for property tax might be considered, given both that the way property tax is currently structured, it puts quite a strong economic burden on the project by having a lot of potential liabilities up front that then taper off further down, and also create a lot of uncertainty for the project given the history of litigation of property taxes, etc. So a big part of that discussion has been, is there a mechanism, whether that be payment in lieu of taxation or something else, that is something that both generates adequate revenue for municipalities and the state, that is transparent and predictable for everyone involved, both the municipalities involved, the state, and through the project, the companies, that everyone can agree to. Some progress has been made on that, but a lot of further work needs to be done to eventually decide what that's going to look like, and event, of course, that will also be something that the legislature needs to eventually approve. And then finally, at the same time as all of those things are going on, there is the permitting process that is already underway, both in terms of export approval through the Department of Energy and the broader FERC permitting process, that of course includes environment, local impacts, and then as part of that, the question of negotiations beginning with local communities for understanding what project impacts are going to be. The FERC permitting process will help understand what those impacts are, but there needs to be a process for understanding how to quantify those impacts in terms of what are reasonable impact payments to communities and how that whole process needs to work. So, lest you thought that one could sort of step back and take a breather, that gives an indication of what is on the plate over the next 12 months.
Very good. Appreciate that.
Well, if there are no questions, let's move on. For the record, Nico Safos, so moving on to slide 4. What we wanted to do is talk about two issues in particular, and they are presented in more detail in two papers that we've made available to the committee today. One is on LNG marketing, the second is on domestic gas. Our goal here is to not provide really any answers right now, but recognizing that these are going to be two crucial questions, try to set a little bit of the framework. You know, how do you think about these things? How do you, what kind of direction do you want to go, and what are the trade-offs that you may face? So I want to start with LNG marketing. Obviously, one of the major novelties of the project is that it raises the possibility of SB 138 raised the possibility that you may take possession of the gas and have to sell it. And so I want to talk about, well, what does that look like? But before I go to Alaska, I want to talk about what that looks like in the world. Right? So this slide 4, it's really about look at a sample of about, you know, 7 or 8 projects. The list in detail is in the paper. We decided to spare you the details of each individual project. But this is what the big takeaway looks like. How much do companies pre-sell before taking final investment decision? Usually 70% or more, right? So for the Alaska LNG project, if you're looking at 16 million tons, you know, you would expect, you know, 12, 13 million tons to be pre-sold before you go into final investment decision. Oftentimes, that could go up all the way up to 100. And these are usually actually exclusively long-term contracts, 20 years. Counterparty, so how many buyers does each project have? So this is not Alaska's share. This is the overall project. Average about 2.9 buyers, ranging from 1 to 6. So there are places where, you know, one company has just bought all the gas, and there are other places with a similar size as Alaska that you have 6 buyers. So pretty broad range. Price exposure, some of the U.S. contracts, some of the U.S. projects are linked to Henry Hub, the gas price. Other outside of the U.S., still a lot of oil indexation.
Excuse me, Nico. Senator Wielichowski has a question.
Thank you. On counterparties, we've got the state, BP, Conoco, Exxon. So we've got 4 parties, and they will all be looking for buyers. So do you see that as being a problem?
Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, I do not. Let me tell you why I do not. If you look at, I don't think of it necessarily just as number of players. I think of it as volume. And if you look at the LNG market, you know, at any given year, you have anywhere from 30, 40, sometimes even more, 50 million tons of LNG that gets contracted on a long-term basis. So if I think about the Alaska LNG project basically having contracts scattered over sort of a 2-3 year period, I think that the 16 to 18 million tons that the project overall is trying to sell can be absorbed by the market. I think the fact that each one company is going to be competing basically for the same buyers, I think that's going to create some tension. It's not tension that the companies have not experienced in the past, but I don't see the volume that Alaska is trying to sell as something that the market wouldn't be able to absorb. If I can then move on to contract size, again, this is all based on a sample of projects for the last 2 years. You had contracts of 1 million tons, and you had contracts of 4-plus million tons. So remember, Alaska LNG project is about 16, 18 million tons. So Alaska has a quarter of that, so you're looking to sell about 4-4.5 million tons. What this bullet says is you may actually even find one buyer if you want, but you may also get three or four.
Nikos, Senator Warlikowski.
Yeah. Can you give me the translation? You've got something there, but 1 ton equals how many MCF? Or
so that's 1 ton would be 132 MCFD. So the range in the parentheses, apologies, through the chair, Senator Warlikowski. So one would be the equivalent of the 132, and the 4 million tons would be the equivalent to the 530.
1 ton equals 132 MCF.
A day.
MCF per day.
The million tons is an annual. Apologies, it's how the industry works, and I realize it's not intuitive, and I think they do it intentionally so that people don't understand what's happening. So 1 million ton per – so the Alaska LNG project is 16 to 18 million tons per annum, okay? And so that equates to a little bit over 2 billion cubic feet a day of gas. And so when you look at the 1 million ton per annum, it's equivalent to 132 million cubic feet a day of gas. Yeah?
132 million cubic feet a day for 1 ton, and this is a 2.5 BCF line. I mean, it's 2.5 BCF per day, right? Help me.
So how do you get to – so the project itself is 16 to 18 million tons
per
annum.
Per year, okay.
Yeah. And so that correlates to roughly a little bit more billion cubic feet of gas.
Per day.
Now, the other complication, which you can please forget right as I say it, is that the amount of gas you put in is different than the amount of gas you get out because there are losses. So sometimes when you hear these numbers, they're not always exactly apples to apples because it kind of refers where you're at. But ultimately, the bottom line is that, you know, you have a quarter of the project, so you'd be looking to sell the equivalent of 500 million cubic feet a day. It's a 2 BCF a day project. So that's sort of more or less how I would think about it. Okay? Thank you for that. The units question is something that I hope an international gas committee could get together and just force everyone to use one standard so we can all know what we're talking about. But. Transfer point, this is basically a way of asking who does the shipping. What we wanted to show here is that there's no real trend. Bottom line is if you want to do the shipping, you can find counterparties that would do that. If you didn't want to do the shipping and you wanted the buyer to arrange the shipping, you wouldn't have a problem with that either. So there's no one way or another where the market is going. And the last part is about a third of the buyers had equity in the project. So this, again, the sample of 7-8 projects for the last few years. And so this either means that a project developer sold gas to themselves, so the contract was between the corporate entity and the project, or a buyer that came to buy gas said, I want a piece of the project. And about a third of the gas of the buyers had equity in the project. So what I take away from this is, with the exception of the fact that you're probably going to pre-sell a lot of the gas, everything else is up for grabs. You guys can do whatever you want, is how I would take this. You can sign one big contract. You can sign lots of little contracts. You can bring in people with equity. You can not bring people with equity. You can do shipping. You cannot do shipping. The point is that this is very tailored to your interests, is what I was trying to get. So this is the world, and I now want to go to Alaska and talk about what that means really for Alaska. So I'm going to switch to the next slide, slide 5. And this, again, all in the paper that we've made available to the committee. And we wanted to put out 4 core principles. And so these are going to be stated with a slightly more in a slightly more emphatic tone. But we recognize that this is really a conversation to have. We just wanted to say, here's how we're thinking about this so that we can get you to start thinking about this and so we can get to the process where we figure out what's best for Alaska. The first principle is we would say focus on performance over time. And what this means is, look, you sign a 20-year deal. It's really easy, the same way you check your portfolio in the stock market, you know, to go from an hour-to-hour base and say, oh, my God, this is a terrible idea, and then the next day, oh, my God, it's the best thing ever. You know, this is really a project where you got to step back and give it time and look at how is this thing performing over a meaningful period of time. Now, obviously, if you feel like year after year, you see the market is doing one thing and you're being left behind, you got to act, right? But this is really, it's really going to be very difficult if your expectations are that on every given day, this has to be the best price in the world, otherwise Alaska is somehow getting shortchanged. I think it's going to be, you're going to struggle with it because you're not going to be able to do much about it on a day-to-day basis anyway. But I think that's a broad principle that we would just put out there for you to think about. The second thing, and this is a crucial difference, is we say focus on risk, not the highest price. Here's what we mean by this, is, you know, the highest price today may not be the highest price tomorrow. Sometimes, if you want to protect yourself on the downside, you have to give some of the upside up. So there may be times where you have the best price, but if you have the best price on good times, you probably have some of the worst prices on bad times because you have no protection on the downside. Right? So what we really wanted to say is that at the end of the day, you have to think about risk. This is all about how much volatility, how much risk are you willing to take. Remember also, this is not like the oil market where you can just pick up the newspaper and look at what the oil price is. This is very fragmented. This is very bilateral, relationship-driven. We talked about confidentiality and companies being very secretive about pricing. So a lot of times you won't even know what the highest price is to be jealous of it because it's really difficult to find out. But the idea is you really should be thinking about risk, volatility, not price, not the highest price at every given point. Now, with that comes the next point, which we think is quite crucial. We talked about it last session that we wanted to introduce it again, which is that we call it don't outsource your risk profile. And here's the way I think about it in a very sort of simple way. Let's say I have an amount of money, and a friend comes and says, hey, I have a buddy. You can invest it with him. He works at a hedge fund. And so you think about it and say, you know what, works at a hedge fund, he probably knows the market really well, but also someone who works at a hedge fund may be willing to do things that I don't really want done with my money. You know, they may be willing to take risks that I don't want be taken with my money. And that's sort of what we would submit is the way to think about your partners. You know, Exxon, ConocoBP may be willing to take risks that you don't want to take. They have exposure that you don't have. They have assets that you don't have. And just because if they sell it for you, in a way, you are adopting their risk tolerance, right? If I give my money to the hedge fund guy, I'm basically saying, look, whatever you do, I'm willing to accept that. And that could be the right approach. Depends on what the risk tolerance is. But it may not be. And so what we would submit to you is the first question to say is that, well, what do I want? And then judge what you get from the companies as, you know, does this suit me? Don't assume that just because they're smart and have been doing this for a long time, that what works for them works for you, is what we would submit to you. And the last thing we would submit to you is to build in-house expertise. This is a really complicated, opaque market, highly fragmented. And our experience looking at sovereigns around the world, any sovereign that has basically, on the marketing of gas, not overall, on the marketing of gas, basically stepped back and said, oil companies, you guys do your thing and send us a check. This has been very convenient. It's very simple to do. But then 5 years later, they kind of look at the numbers. It's like, hey, what's going on here? And they feel like they're getting shortchanged, but they don't know because there's no one that really knows what this market is about. And so one of the key ways in which you're going to understand your risk profile and be able to manage your risk profile is to have people that know how to do it. And so we would submit to you that when you think about the marketing of gas, this is an area where the more you know, the more experienced you are, the more sophisticated you are, the better you will be able to protect yourself, take advantage of opportunities, and have a technical team that is able to achieve the broad strategic direction that you and the administration give them. So if you say, look, what I care about is stability of revenue. I'm just making this up, right? For example, you may say, look, oil market is crazy. we're dealing with a budget now, and you've gone from 120 to 40, we can't deal with that. We can't have, you know, state salaries and public services be subject to this volatility. Go find a deal for me that, yeah, I may lose something on the upside, but just give me stability. You know, that could be something you asked for as this legislature, as the administration. And there are many ways to do that, and I think you need a group of really sophisticated people to do that for you, and you won't be able to get that by just having an arm's length agreement on the marketing side. So those are the kind of things that, again, on a broad strategic way, we're not saying whether you should sell to Japan or Korea or China, you know, who you should go talk to. We can get into those discussions. We're talking about meaning of life stuff, which is just really high level things. And so if I could go to slide six, just to close the marketing conversation. This is not, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I want to kind of go back to the slide four that I said is, you have so many levers to get what you want, and you should really think about those levers, right? So to go back to the question of volatility, you may decide, look, I got 4 million tons. Maybe I want 2 million tons to be really, really fixed. You know what? I'm willing to take very little price risk just to make sure that I get this amount of money to cover my debt, to cover some base payments. The same way you design an investment portfolio, right? You put some in bonds, you put some in big equities, you put some in sort of emerging markets. You know, you think about a portfolio. And here you have just a lot, because this is really tailored stuff. You have a lot of tools at your disposal to really come up with a risk profile that you're comfortable with. And so we think that this is the kind of conversation that's going to be really helpful, so that, you know, when the administration is going out to Japan and Korea and China and elsewhere, or when it's negotiating with the big producers, you know, it has some direction of, what, look, this is what really matters to us. And we think that obviously, you know, this is the kind of conversation that at some level can be really public, but at some level should also be sort of kept close to your chest, because you're negotiating, right? You don't want to just kind of go out and say, oh, yeah, we're willing to give up all this upside if you give us this. You know, you want to have a little bit of leverage as you do that, right? And so these are sort of all the different ways in which we think we can get to that ultimate endpoint, and you should really think of this as, you know, different levers that you can move around in order to get to your desired result. So this is all I had about LNG marketing. I'm going to just pause for 1 second, and then otherwise we're going to go to domestic gas.
Any questions on marketing? All right, seeing none.
Perfect.
Thanks for taking.
Slide seven. Before I talk about slide seven, let me step back. Why are we doing this? Obviously, number one priority for the state of Alaska is getting energy to Alaskans. And so one of the things that happens is, you know, LNG projects are big projects, right? And so people always ask, you know, how does this project affect the local market? And if you look at the Lower 48 has struggled with this. You know, if you allow LNG exports, does that raise prices? You know, this is, the Department of Energy has done a number of studies on this. This is a question that people struggle with. In Eastern Australia, in Queensland, you know, there's been a lot of LNG development. Domestic consumers are seeing prices rise because there's less gas available. So that was the point of departure. And so we were asked to say, well, why don't you guys take a look at that? Tell us what you think. So we kind of, there's sort of two ways to do this. One is we could take out our microeconomics textbook and put out a graph of supply and demand and tell you what shifts, what goes left, what goes right, what goes up, what goes down. Both of us are economists, so we said, let's not do that. Instead of trying to put some kind of really murky model, let's just kind of try to find a case where someone has really gone through the same thing and try to figure out, you know, what happened to them. And so we looked at around the world, and we tried to find, you know, a developed country, right? So we didn't want to tell you about, you know, what happens in Qatar or Russia where, you know, domestic prices are regulated or subsidized. So we wanted to pick a country that, you know, you could relate to, right? So we picked Western Australia, and it's nothing to do with Janik here. It really just was the best case for it. And so Western Australia started exporting gas in 1989. It has five LNG trains at Northwest Shelf with a capacity of about what the Alaska LNG project is. And they also have a new project at Pluto, about 4 million tons. So it exports a little bit over 20 million tons. So it's not dissimilar to the volume that the Alaska LNG project is going to be exporting. And so what did the Western Australians learn throughout this sort of 20 years of experience? There are these five takeaways, and they're in the paper that we wrote to accompany the presentation. The first thing, which actually sort of surprised us, because it's not what the economics textbook says, which is why we wanted to not talk about the economic textbooks. We want to talk about real world. The first thing was that there's really no set link between export and domestic prices. There's no sort of, you know, established relationship or expected relationship between the two things. There is in theory. In theory, you say, hey, you know, if you can export, if you can sell the domestic market, the two things should move together. Well, if you look at the chart here, you know, domestic price, we're doing one thing. Export price, we're doing another thing. Part of it is because of the contracts. You know, you've signed different contracts that are very sticky. Part of it actually has to do, in the case of Australia, with the Australian dollar that really changes prices for exports. So a lot of things happen, and we'll talk a little bit about how Alaska fits into this in a second. So bear with me. Just put your mind in Western Australia for a few minutes. The second thing is that just because exports are possible doesn't mean that every company wants to export. And I think that's really important. There's always a fear that if you do exports, no one's going to look at the local market anymore because everyone wants to do export. Well, even in Australia, you had a lot of companies, you know, Apache down there in the yellow. The green line on the bottom slide, on the bottom chart, is Northwest Shelf. So this is the export project. This is how much they sell in the local market. But Apache, this is all domestic gas, right? And so for Apache, you know, LNG doesn't fit their risk appetite. It's too capital intensive, has too many risks. They would rather just produce gas and sell it in the local Western Australia market. So the bottom line is, just because there's an LNG project doesn't mean everyone wants to do exports via LNG. Third part is Western Australia has a reservation policy that basically today says 15% of the gas has to go to the local market. Okay? And so if you look back in time in the 1980s when they sort of first negotiated some agreements to get some of this gas for the local market, you can see that in the green chart when it takes off in 1984. What they did is, in the effort to secure enough gas for the local market, they kind of crashed the price. Because they basically made Northwest Shelf, they signed such a big commitment to make sure that everyone in Western Australia had gas. And so because everyone in Western Australia had gas, no one wanted to explore because there was no market. There was nowhere to take the gas. And you can see that from the fact that, you know, in the late 80s, basically Northwest Shelf had almost 100% market share. No one else was producing. The price, as you can see on the top, went from about these are Australian dollars, or kind of fake dollars. So from about eight, my apologies. This was just meant for someone. You know, it went from about eight to, you know, five, and then kept going down. So, you know, the lesson was, in the effort to secure enough supply, they oversupplied and they crashed the market. The fourth conclusion is, clearly having a reservation policy makes a difference. There were LNG projects that said on the record, there was a parliamentary inquiry into this topic. They said on the record, you know what, if it weren't for the reservation policy, we couldn't care less about the domestic market. I mean, they said it more elegantly, but that was the punchline. But at the same time, just because you have a reservation policy, because they have this experience, you know, they said, well, we're going to commit the gas, but we're not going to just sell it overnight because then that's going to crash the price. So just having a reservation policy clearly makes people pay attention, but there's still market forces at work. And the last thing is, you know, policy and advanced planning is no substitute for close oversight and diligent regulation. What I mean by this is, there was, I think, a sense in Western Australia that, you know what, if we have a reservation policy, or if we just get these guys to commit to sell 15% of the gas, we can just step back and, you know, eat chips and see while this thing plays out. And what they realized, you just can't do that. You have to be constantly, diligently monitoring the market, making sure that you can make it work. And so one of the key conclusions that they got to is that instead of asking, how do we keep this gas at home, they asked, how do I regulate this new market given the fact that there is a big LNG facility to it? And that is a huge difference in mental thinking. Rather than focusing on the LNG project, you focus on the market given the fact that there's an LNG project there. And that leads you to do different things. They did, you know, bulletin boards, transparency initiatives, whether marketing was jointly by the joint venture or individually by partners. Lots of tools that were available to the disposal in order to create more competition and make sure that the market was sort of working for the benefit of Western Australians.
Question. Yes, Senator Michiki.
And I just want to start, Janik, I don't know about the value, but the little plastic windows around the Queen and your dollar, I think, are pretty cool. So, so I agree that this, and I know we all have an eye on this, this project must include fairly priced natural gas for Alaskans for domestic use. But can you talk a little bit about the inverse relationship on stranded gas removing the incentive for E&P in a region, which can dramatically increase the cost when in the highest price of production is curtailment, right? So in a small scale, we can look at Cook Inlet, and a large scale, we can look at Henry Hub. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Senator Manchika, through the chair, I'm not sure I fully understand the question. Would you mind taking one more shot at it?
So, yes, there's the potential to increase the cost of domestic gas because you put it on a global market. Mm-hmm. There's also the potential to increase the cost of local gas through reduced production, eventually restricting supply. So there's a relationship there. It's an inverse relationship to attaching your product to the global market. So can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, there is a – so Cook Inlet's good model. Henry Hub's probably a better one, but I'd like to see how you feel about it.
Senator Manchika, through the chair, that was much clearer in my mind. If you don't mind, actually, if I can go to slide 8, because it takes some of that experience and applies to Alaska and also talks about Cook Inlet, which in our mind is also a good example of the fact that domestic prices and export prices don't automatically correlate, right? In our mind...
And, Nikos, I just want to make sure you're aware we have 15 minutes
left. Yes, I have the watch here.
Okay, great. Thank you.
The last two slides are really about finance, okay. And they sort of just remind you some of the things we talked about last year. So my point is we're not going to cry too much if we don't get to it. What I was saying, Senator Manchika, through the chair, is, you know, the way we read Cook Inlet, it was a good example of this, which is that there was a time where the prices were really linked. They sort of moved together. They were connected because they were both pegged to oil, et cetera. And there was a time they were not, right? And so we think what really matters is having what the market forces are in this environment. So if you think about the lower 48, the way – my apologies for doing this – but the way to think about it is in a supply-demand microeconomic model is you say, look, lower 48 let's focus on the U.S. only, you know, consumes 70 billion cubic feet a day. If you export, you then need to have demand for 90 billion cubic feet a day or 80 billion cubic feet a day. And in theory, the more you demand, you need higher cost of gas to get to that, right? Because the theory is that you're already developing your cheaper gas, and so the more you demand, the more you go to more expensive gas. So this is the sort of textbook economic way to think about the market. And so if you look at the lower 48, the studies that the Department of Energy has done, the big conclusion is this is the first move, which is that you add demand, and so therefore you push up the price. The question then is, well, what do people do? Well, if you have a well-functioning market, you have competition, you thinking about regulation, supply should respond to that. And so that's why, you know, that takes us to the punchline of the previous slide. And this slide, which is the ultimate goal is not to think about domestic and export markets, to think about how do I make sure that there's enough, that market forces work in the local market, given the fact that you can export, right? And as we suggest, that there are a number of policy options that you can have to do that. And I think the Cook Inlet is a good example that shows you domestic prices, you can still have affordable gas, even though Japan is paying a lot more. It shows you that what really matters is local market forces. It also shows you that just because there's exports available doesn't mean that companies like Hillcorp aren't going to step in to supply gas to the local market. So I think one of the things we like the Western Australia example is because it really spoke to a lot of the both the experience as well as the challenges that Alaska faces. Now, the ultimate punchline here is that we don't think that having this broad structure is enough for you to step back and say, we've done a great job, pat yourselves in the back, and let it be, right? This is a 20-25-year endeavor. And it's going to require a lot of monitoring and a lot of thinking through, and frankly, from Australia, a lot of tweaking. You know, what works in the beginning of a project may not work
10 years down the line or 15 years down the line or 20 years down the line. And so, you know, what we wanted to submit to you is when you step back, you know, there's going to be a temptation to try to figure everything out for the long term. And if you do that, what we would like to help you do is also try to think through some of the unintended consequences of that, because you may do things that you didn't intend. But, I mean, one of the biggest, which I know has come up, is, you know, what happens to Cook Inlet suppliers if you just bring a ton of gas from the north that comes in possibly at a cheaper price? You know, do you basically disincentivize anyone in the Cook Inlet to go find gas? You know, those are the kind of things that, you know, it's useful to think about, right? It may not happen, right? You can guard against it. But it's all about thinking about the Alaskan domestic market given LNG rather than just focusing your eyes on the Alaska LNG project and thinking about, you know, how the Alaska LNG project do A, B, C, D. Does that answer your question in some ways?
It does. I wanted to just place focus on that inverse relationship. And also in local considerations, it's very difficult to compete with local production. That's another focus we have in Cook Inlet. It's very difficult to compete with local production as opposed to production that moves 800 miles through a... So, yeah. Interesting. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, then if I can go back to this slide, we talked about the top part, and I think we've talked about the bottom part as well. And so I don't really want to say much more on domestic gas. I just want to remind you that both of the marketing and the domestic gas have papers associated with them, and the intention was, again, to start the conversation at the legislative level, because those are the kind of things that, you know, the legislature will have to come to some sort of agreement, both in terms of what it's willing to approve, but also to give guidance to the administration. So we thought both of these papers would take us towards that direction, so we can all sort of start thinking from the same page in terms of having a common understanding of the world and then having conversations about where we want to go. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Janik for the last two slides.
All right.
For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. The last two slides I think we can cover really very briefly. I've touched on these issues before, which is that one of the things, of the many things that will come back, ideally, given the timeline that's been laid out later this year, in terms of agreements, is the question of some initial decisions that are going to have to be made, in particular, for instance, around the ongoing participation of TransCanada in this, the signing of a long-term binding transportation and gas transportation services agreement with TransCanada. Crucial to thinking through the issues there is the question of what the state's alternatives are in terms of financing its share of the gas treatment and facilities and pipeline, and how, for instance, were the state to go it alone without TransCanada, what its cost of capital under a range of different circumstances might be, and how that compares to what is on offer in terms of the tariff applied in such an agreement with TransCanada, and how that, how those different costs stack up against the other benefits that come from having TransCanada in the mix. To get to an educated decision on that requires a lot of analysis, it seems to us, on really understanding what the state's capacity for financing the capital requirement here is, in terms of what's born in equity, what's born in debt, what the state's direct capacity on its balance sheet is for taking on debt, what the other solutions for debt are. One of the things we've talked about a lot last year, for instance, is in the world of projects like this, not all financing is done directly on balance sheet by lots of companies. Project finance, non-recourse finance is something that's very well established. The basic idea behind non-recourse finance is that rather than a loan being guaranteed, for instance, in the commercial world by the parent, that the company, whether that be in the case of Alaska LNG, a BP, an ExxonMobil, a ConocoPhillips, project debt is debt, or for instance, the state of Alaska, project debt is rather debt that is borne by the project company itself without recourse to the cash flows or assets of the parent company. It's instead secured and collateralized against the future cash flows and assets of the project company itself, and that is the only recourse that the debt holders have to the project. Because that's the only recourse that that the debt holders have, two things become very important. One, that's a big driver for the fact that so much of LNG that is sold in the world is sold under 20-odd year contract, because it's those contracts and the bankability and credit ratings, etc., of the counterparties to those contracts that ultimately determines a big part of the price of debt involved. And because of those things, frequently that debt is more expensive than debt that, you know, a AAA-rated sovereign might incur with debt financing that ultimately has recourse to them. Nonetheless, it's a way of providing financing that has much less, if any, impact directly on, you know, the balance sheet, credit rating, etc., of either a parent company or, in the case of the state of Alaska, the state. So thinking about what the different options that are available to the state in meeting the capital requirement of a project like this, and starting to think about, you know, several different scenarios of how that could be done, and how that compares, for instance, to the cost of financing implicit in a tariff that would be paid to TransCanada, is something that both the administration and the legislature need to do a lot of this year. That's a process that's been started with a preliminary report, I gather, delivered by Lazard, part of the work product required under SB 138, and that starts to set out some of the possibilities in slightly more detail, you know, for instance, than is on this slide. But there is a whole suite of further work to do on that front in terms of really understanding what those costs truly are and coming to an informed decision about how one weighs one up against the other. This final slide is simply to say that on that question of project finance in the context of non-recourse debt, you know, this is very well established in among major LNG projects. These are some recent big transactions involving big LNG projects, and the sort of dollar figures that were raised in terms of non-recourse project debt and who some of the counterparties were. You'll see that, you know, large export credit agencies, for instance, and export-import banks are very active in this market, as are big commercial syndicated loan banks. You know, the JP Morgan Chases, the Citibanks, the Bank of Americas of this world are all big players in this sort of market. That concludes our presentation.
Very good. Questions from committee members?
Chair?
Yes, Senator Machicki.
Before we adjourn, could we go back to confidentiality after you get through asking any questions about this presentation?
Sure. Were there any other questions about this presentation, project overview, financing? Seeing none. Question, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I just wanted to cover a little something. One of the things we didn't discuss is that executive session and confidentiality is essentially covered in Alaska law, right? So we have section AS 42 or 44.62.310, which defines government meetings public. It talks about executive session, and it covers — I'm doing this on a phone, so excuse me — but it covers some of the subjects, and one is one with the — it covers financial information. It covers things that could prejudice the reputation and character of any person. It covers medical issues, a lot of other issues. But I guess one of the things I wanted to talk about is I was a small town mayor, right? So I'm going to scale this discussion a little bit, but the scale that I want to cover, and you talk about tipping your hat. I think you said it's like playing poker with your cards showing. But We would pull into executive session for certain things, and what's most important is that it's never abused. It's only used where it's applicable in Alaska law. But examples in the city that I operate is, Fred Meyer was going to expand their pharmacy and didn't want to tip the hat of other competitors that could come into town. I mean, there were restaurant expansions or people coming in with a new business. They were about to go through the permitting process. Reality of it is that this is just a little bit more impactful to the Alaska state of Alaska's finances than a Fred Meyer and Soldat. I think it's an appropriate use. Again, we need to be on guard against overuse, but I think we've made the point in several meetings here that confidentiality has its place. It's limited and should never be abused, but I do want Alaskans to hear that. It's an appropriate use, and I think we've covered that enough in discussions, but I hope people understand that even in their local government, if they attend those meetings, they're gonna see that used on a regular basis in the proper application.
Very good.
Thank you. Well, with that, that ends the subject matter for today. Our next meeting is Friday, January 30th. We'll be hearing from Steve Butt, who is the project engineer for AKLNG. And so at this time, I will adjourn. The time is exactly 5 p.m.